welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Odd Job Pod. I am your host, Gary Andrews, and as one person once said, ours is the loneliest job in the world. But while we're in isolation, we thought we'd pour ourselves another Vespa and watch for a back catalogue of Bond, essentially doing what every other middle-aged white male is doing at the moment and thinking, you know what, I should probably start a podcast. Well, we beat you to it. We've already been doing this for a few years. And let me tell you, you're probably not going to be quite like this one if you start. Joining me as ever on the podcast are Graham Sibley and Terry DeFellin. Good evening, gents. How are you both?
Good evening. We're both well. Well, I'm well. I think Graham's well as well.
I am well as well. Yes, I'm well as well.
Excellent. We're all well. This is good. We're all socially isolating and distant, which is good.
We're very distant from you, Gary. We're a good 10,000 miles away, I think.
Yes, I mean, it's a bit extreme, but difficult times call for difficult measures and all that. So, yes, this is obviously a strange time that we're recording it in, but if there's one silver lining, it's that an Australian TV channel has been showing every film from James Bond, and they're currently midway through. So I'm midway through the Moors at the moment, I think you can say. And it's a great time to really just get back in and do what we love best, which is getting really, really nerdy about James Bond. So as we were chatting, we thought, you know what? Let's go for one of the lesser appreciated in the Moore canon, which is Man with a Golden Gun, which is what we're going to be discussing today. And I think there will be some interesting opinions, some blistering hot takes, and many other things. But first, Graham, I've got to ask you, what do you know about Scaramanga?
Francisco Scaramanga. Yes, guy with three nipples, Man with a Golden Gun. Love is required wherever he's hide. So I've heard. It comes just before the kill. yeah. That's one of the more famous intros, isn't it? Where Roger saunters into M's office and starts just like waxing lyrical about someone who he's just been asked about off the top of his head. Yes, like as if he's been like cribbing up on the bus in.
It's probably one of my favourite scenes from the movie, just because it's probably Roger at his best. Now, I found this really... We were been obviously coordinating via various social networks and messaging apps for this. Now, as we were discussing we're going to do it, Graham had said, it's a film I would love to like a lot better than it is. Terry then went off and did his duty and watched it. And Terry... let's just dive straight in. How did you feel after watching Man with the Golden Gun or rewatching it?
I must confess, I thought it was pretty awful. It's a movie, like all of the James Bond films, it's the one that I've seen this film so many times. I mean, all of the James Bond films when I was a teenager, I'd watch them on VHS and then I'd rewind them and then I'd watch them again because I was a very lonely teenager and I didn't go out much and I'd watch the James Bond films and I loved Man with the Golden Gun, and I do love it in the way that you always love just simply because of the time it reminds you of, or because, you know, back when I was a teenager, I just used to like movies like that. I used to find all of those things that are rubbish about this film, I used to think were really, really good. And now, you know, thinking, right, we have to do a podcast, let's sit down, watch this movie through modern eyes, you know, and you just think, oh no, this really is, it's not a very good film at all. And yes, I mean, on our WhatsApp group, I did, I made it clear what I thought of the film. It is a pretty awful film.
Graham, I mean, when we look at this film, you look at the elements that you've got in it. You've got a villain who is meant to be Bond's equal. You've got Christopher Lee. You've got Britt Eklund. You've got a lot of really thrilling cities within there. You would go, if you put them all together and somebody described what the plot was, I don't know about you, but I would go, that sounds like a fantastic Bond film. I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with it. The last podcast we did was the elements of a great Bond film. Where we went through all the things you should put into a Bond film for it to be really, really good. And you're right, Gary, this does have all of those elements that you would think of or what you would look for in something that in a Bond film, in a corking Bond film. The problem is that it just doesn't work very well. I mean, it just relies on all these props, basically, all these Bond nods, and it forgets to weave them all together in something that is watchable and entertaining. You're right, it does have all the right things there. All of the right things are there, but they're just hideously underused or just used very, very, very poorly. And then you've got other things that are just shamefully tacked on, which probably didn't even make a lot of sense at the time. Like the whole of the sort of like the kung fu stuff, it is very, very early 70s, and it's a lovely nod to that genre. But it's just done so ham-fistedly. And in many ways, I quite like that. There is that one where he's just escaping from the dojo, wherever you want to call it. And there's this one last guy who runs after him to have at him. When you look at it and you see the guy, and he does it very, very well, I must admit, but it's so obvious, so telegraphed, where he's actually putting all his effort into jumping off the bridge to help Roger Moore look like he's throwing him off there. And but the thing is, for that just encapsulate the whole thing, where everything else has to happen, has to help Roger really go through this thing to give it some form of excitement.
I think you've kind of touched on many, many things there. And Terry, when you were kind of watching it, I suspect you're probably taking notes as well. And what kind of your thoughts of, God, where could this have turned from what is a bit of a ropey addition to the Bond film into a film that actually could have been up there? Because as we've said, it's got the elements that you would want from a Bond film.
It starts off extremely promisingly. It reminds me to a degree of Die Another Day, in that it begins with a very interesting premise. You've got the island. You've got the guy with the three nipples. It's Christopher Lee. It's funny because in the opening, those few opening seconds of the movie, you could actually be mistaken for thinking that actually this, and I'm sure this was probably a conceit from the filmmakers, from Guy Hamilton, was that actually was James Bond about to appear. And then suddenly it's Christopher Lee, who is a world famous actor, instantly recognizable to any audience. And that must have been quite an interesting juxtaposition, I think, for the audience. And then you've got the whole sequence with the Fun Palace and the Chicago mobster in Thailand, although we didn't know it was, in Red Chinese Waters, although we didn't know that at the time, turning up there, and that whole Fun Palace routine. And it was very evocative of, a Brian Clemens sort of like Avengers kind of story. It had a lot of promise. And yet the setup was interesting. The fact that, Scaramanga, what an interesting character. An interesting Bond villain, this mystery guy who charges £1 million, which in 1973 is a fantastic amount of money. The setup's really good. And for me, I think where the film, from a plot and story point of view, goes wrong is when they introduce the Solex agitator, when that suddenly shoehorns its way into the plot. Because I have a feeling that Tom Mankiewicz's original script was didn't include the Solex. That was brought in at a later time, and I believe that really it was going to be just a story about this kind of cat and mouse thriller between Bond and Scaramanga. And I think that the film would have been a lot better if they had stuck to that principle, because where the film redeems itself is when Christopher Lee is in it, and the film is actually at its best. And Graham will tell you this because he talks about it a lot. In fact, he can't not talk about it on an episode of Oddjob Pod, and that is those scenes between Roger Moore and Christopher Lee in the final scenes of the movie, which are among some of the best Bond villain exchanges in the franchise. So the film's not without redemption, but I think it's because they tacked on that they added the Solex agitator plot to add some additional global peril, which probably wasn't necessary.
Yes, I mean, there is definitely more than a bit of mild peril in there. But Graham, yeah, would you go along with that? There's a fantastic start, fantastic end, and it's just a bit of a shame that you have to sit through some bits in the middle which are not quite as good.
Well, Terry's right. It changes its mind what it wants to be all the way through. And in fact, if it had taken just one of those elements and just run with it, it would have probably been a better film. There's a point probably about halfway, probably when J.W. Pepper turns up in it, where it just becomes pure caper movie, which we love caper movies. I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with an Italian job style film if you want to make one. But you've really got to stick with it throughout the whole thing. You can't just cut in and out of being a caper movie. A caper movie is a caper movie. That's all it is. Yeah, yeah. You didn't think it was going to get that profound, did you, on this podcast? But yeah, I went there unapologetically. I did go there.
You went into mild caper rather than mild peril.
I always do, Gary. You know me. And of course, when you've got things like, well, it does suit that type of film, because you've got Britt Ekland there. Britt Ekland just turned up to be the not even the useful idiot, the really really not useful at all idiot amongst there as comedy sidekick in a bikini. Very very early 70s, very sort of like Confessions of a Secret Agent. So that's another element of the film that it is. And then you've got this whole travelogue thing going on in the background. Say, look, the mysterious Far East. Look what they're doing here. Look, isn't this lovely? Look, this is where the Queen Elizabeth is now. Oh, look, here's our secret base on the Queen Elizabeth. There's a lot of things in this film that are memorable, really memorable. But I think that's one of the problems with it. It looked like for instance the scene when they're on the beach when they're having the old Pistols at Dawn duel, and you can see, well, look, this is obviously a setup for publicity stills. This is obviously before a time when they realize, you know, you can make your publicity stills that don't have to be in the film. You can actually like just put Christopher Lee and Roger Moore back to back on a beach holding guns, and it doesn't have to actually be in the film. It can just be a sort of like a metaphor for what's actually going on. It's just really lax. This film was actually Saltzman's last one before he left the partnership with Broccoli, and actually he had very little to do on this film. This is Broccoli on his own. You can get that sort of feeling that something is missing behind the scenes there. And I think that does explain quite a lot, where Saltzman had everything he touched in the 60s was gold. And then all of a sudden, within a space of a couple of years, things started falling apart for him as far as a few business decisions went. And it was getting acrimonious between him and Broccoli, and there was court cases. And there was the other stuff of the ownership rights of Bond as well in the background. And you can just see this was the start of where things were going to go for the next decade and be a bit bumpy. And not that that should excuse the poor features of this film, but I think it maybe goes some way to explain it.
Well, I was reading up, doing a bit of reading, and I didn't realise that it really, like, box office wise, this really wasn't a particularly big success either compared to Live and Let Die, which beforehand was, and it really kind of, I think, kind of accelerated a few things as well, because obviously you mentioned the image rights, and you've got that gap as well, which enabled them to then, you then had Never Say Never Again, but obviously Bond came back a lot stronger with probably one of the best entries from the Moore franchise there in The Spy Who Loved Me, which followed it in there. Terry, one of the other things that when I'm talking about disjointed, and I'm obviously sort of going to come to you on this one because I know it's your passion, but one of the things that really struck me about this film from the start as well was just actually the music feels a bit out of timber with the rest of the film as well, from Lulu's theme song all the way through, it doesn't feel like, it's almost as Graham described it as well. There's bits which are good, and then there are bits which are just seem a bit off kilter. And it's almost like they've tried to go, well, we did something a bit different last time with Live and Let Die, which obviously was a fantastic soundtrack and fantastic film. And this one as well, it doesn't, and we talked about how the soundtrack really has to sort of fit in with the Bond film. And this one, to me, really emphasizes the uneven, sheer unevenness of the film as well.
As you say, as Graham pointed out, as the listeners know, the film is set in the Far East, so it's good. And John Barry was never a big fan of sort of like doing what, you know, you might describe as authentic music that was sort of like reflective of the sort of like musical culture of the location. You had a little bit in the dojo scenes where he was doing a lot, and at High Fats Castle Up Gardens where he was doing a little bit of that, but he never really went in for that sort of thing. And so what you've got is you've actually got a score that's it represents a bit of a turning point for Barry, because this is the first gun barrel sequence that doesn't have the plunky guitar for the Bond theme, and he would never use it again for the remainder of his time on that franchise. And so it's a kind of a first of its kind in that case. But he himself stated when he talked about this one, he said that he could just never get his head round the film and get his head round the score in the film. And of course, it's probably most infamous for the penny whistle during the car stunt over the canal. One of the most extraordinary, dangerous, and impressive stunts up until that point. They licensed that stunt and put it on tour because it was just such an amazing stunt to do. And Barry's sort of like decision to use the tin whistle was, by his own admission, was a big mistake, because it completely removed any of the drama or peril from the moment in what actually was an amazingly impressive piece of film work. When you then move forward, say, 3 years to Spy Who Loved Me, when you had the guy skiing off the cliff, where they took an entirely different approach to that, where they had no music at all, and it was only delivered the big payoff when the Union Jack parachute was emerged, and then that was the cue for a comedic moment, and that worked really, really well. And it, for me, that sequence, that car chase in general, just sums up just how this film just never got it right. It had the production values and the high technical standards, but wasn't taking itself seriously. And as I believe I've bored listeners and you in the past, the secret of a good Bond film is that it takes itself seriously and it obeys its own rules, even if what it's doing is absurd.
That's why Christopher Lee works so well, because that's what he always does when he turns up in his film. No matter how ridiculous the character he's asked to play, he plays it entirely straight and does it with all full belief that he's in a top level film. That's why when it comes down to it, when they are, and yes, here I go, when they are sat down at a table and are discussing things, it's a brilliant scene, because it's not got all the old crap associated the rest of the film tries to tack on. This is like a film version of Buckaroo, isn't it? They just want to see how much stuff they can just put on there before it just kicks up.
It's almost kind of like if you think to a certain extent with Lee and Moore, perhaps not quite in the same heavyweight, but there was a certain something when I was watching that end bit where they were going sort of toe-to-toe that had that little bit of, reminded me a little bit of the coffee shop scene between De Niro and Pacino in Heat. Where I mean, yes, this is probably a bit of an odd comparison. You probably wouldn't put...
No. Run with it. Run with it, Gary.
But... You've got that wonderful bit where actually, and for me, this is another one where I think there's a lost opportunity, because this is Moore's second film. And actually, when you look at it, when he's given his bits in there, Moore does such a fantastic job when he's given the right material to work with. He's almost at the top of his game. And Graham, for me, it's a shame that almost some of the later films where he perhaps was flagging, shall we say, a little bit, wasn't maybe like A View to a Kill, wasn't brought in for this one. If that, obviously, View to a Kill is very much of its time, it's a very 80s film, but just think how good it would have been if you had peak Roger Moore going toe-to-toe with Christopher Walken.
Exactly. And I think not that the A View to a Kill didn't have a lot of stuff thrown in there, but that shows you what just actually a bit more thought to the storyline, the way it progresses, there's nothing in A View to a Kill that isn't in some way, shape or form in Man with the Golden Gun. It's just done better.
And also it sets out its story from the very, very beginning. And in last podcast, I mentioned that this was why Moonraker was a good film, was because although it was a piece of absurd theatre, it laid out its absurdity at the very, very beginning. It made it abundantly clear to the audience what was happening. And A View to a Kill does the same with this very elaborate and somewhat comedic ski chase, whereas Man with the Golden Gun thinks it's a proper serious sort of like, you know, spy thriller movie for the first 15 minutes of it, and then it decides to change tack entirely. And I mean, ultimately, that is one of the main reasons why the movie doesn't work. That and, you know, the largely outlandish plot and you know, just terrible characterization. I mean, the everybody is just so pissed off with each other in this movie. I mean, like, you know, M is constantly miserable. There's that glorious moment when he's had the car chase explained to him and Scaramanga's escape on the car that sprouts wings, as he puts it, and flies away. And, you know, really his dismay and contempt could almost be a metaphor for the audience, who by this point are expressing the same contempt to the script writers for what they've got so far. Fortunately, at that point, the movie improves because we move into its denouement when we get to the interesting stuff. But I mean, you've got to obey your own rules of the movie that you set out, and unfortunately Golden Gun just changes them.
Have either of you two read the book at all from Man with the Golden Gun?
Definitely, yes.
Yes. I mean, it's for me, it's again, I wish they'd stuck to the book. And my understanding, and I might be wrong on this, was that they felt that they'd gone to Jamaica too many times, so they wanted to go Far East, and also they felt it was worth cashing in on the kung fu phrase. But again, part of me was thinking, if they'd stuck closer to the spirit of the book, again, you've got potentially, you know, quite a decent movie that could have been spun out of that.
Yeah, the book is a direct sequel to You Only Live Twice. So it's and that's not the movie You Only Live Twice. That's the book You Only Live Twice. I'm less inclined to give away spoilers for Fleming novels, because it's possible listeners haven't read the Fleming novels, and they should, because they're excellent. But it is in the aftermath of the very dramatic turn of events that happen in You Only Live Twice that Man with the Golden Gun takes place. And yeah, it's a much more stripped back adventure. And a lot of that also is because it was published posthumously, and Fleming hadn't finished it. It was nearly finished, but there's quite a lot of segments of the prose which are very much stripped back. Nevertheless, it's an extremely compelling read. And you know, I would say it's actually a very enjoyable book. And it is sort of, you know, it's disappointing that, you know, I think also, can we say, no, I mean, it's like Diamonds Are Forever. It's like, you know, where it's just like, we're just going to use the title and some of the key characters of this book, but we're not actually going to really worry too much about, you know, sticking to the plot. And that's the way it was really with Man with the Golden Gun, the movie, unfortunately.
Graham, with Man with the Golden Gun as well, you've obviously got this bit which seems to afflict Bond films quite a bit. In the second one, you've had a brilliant launch with a new Bond, and then the second one seems to suddenly go a little bit askew in there. And I kind of feel this, it's obviously not quite the same for Connery, which was obviously second film in there, was From Russia With Love, and Dalton escaped that mainly because he only did two, and they're both quite good. But for Brosnan and Craig as well, it kind of has a bit of a sense of, we'll chuck in all the elements that worked before, and draft's done, let's go for the pub, lads.
It very much. I think it this does have a feel of being edited on a Friday afternoon. It was that's the whole thing I get from it. And yes, it only comes out a year after Live and Let Die, doesn't it? It's the same thing with Quantum of Solace. Comes out shamefully close to the previous film, and it's been rushed. And you get the sense that that's what's happened here as well. Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't want to keep banging on about the misplaced opportunity, but they managed to get all these guys together. They managed to get an established Bond director there, good writer, and yet it just doesn't work. Just doesn't work.
So let's go a little bit and imagine, Graham, for a minute, that you are Albert Broccoli. Now, what would you, if you were, you had kind of control over this film, where would you have taken it? What would you have liked to have done with it now that you've watched it through many times? We know what the flaws are. Let's focus on the bits that we really like. How would you have taken this and made it into probably, I mean, it had the potential to be a really good entry into the Bond canon.
I think what you have to do is have to get that whole cat and mouse thing with Bond and Scaramanga working straight away, and I think it might have been nicer to actually have more of the Gibson storyline, because when Gibson turns up and is shot, it's just another bloke on the street, isn't it? And they, oh yeah, that was the guy that you were investigating earlier, remember? And it's just, well, yeah, this is just the M's exposition. This is when you go and buy popcorn, isn't it? This is the, and it doesn't actually mean anything. And I think that's what it could have done. But it might have made it a completely different film. I mean, Terry's right. The look and feel of the sort of funhouse opening. There is Avengers there. There's also like nods to the Prisoner, maybe even the Ipcris file as well, with the lighting and everything there. And you get this sort of feeling that you're actually going into a really high end spy film here. And there are elements of it, but all the elements that you would associate with spy degenerate into caper, which spy can do quite readily, but it is more like Carry On Spying than the Ipcris file, isn't it?
Terry, where would you take this film? Building on Graham's kind of suggestion there, you're then handed the reins. Where would you go with Man with the Golden Gun?
I would have probably dispensed with the Solex element of it completely. I mean, I think the fact that, I mean, as Graham's pointed out, that very small moment of the movie when Gibson is in it, I think just illustrates just how poorly conceived that notion was. You know, I think that you've got four potential key characters in the movie. You've got the two guys, you've got Scaramanga and Bond, and then you've got Andrea and you've got Mary Goodnight, and you could have perhaps had a good thing going on developing the different relationships within those four. You know, I mean, like, there were some good moments between Christopher Lee and Maud Adams, who is as we know, a sublime actress. And I mean, obviously, you know, and Britt Eklund, who, I don't know, I think for me tends to veer more towards glamour model on the spectrum of sort of like of acting, but nevertheless is a competent actress and could have done an awful lot more, you know, if she'd been given the opportunity. I mean, really, the female characters, and Bond girls don't often, it's not uncommon for Bond girls to not be given their full potential. But really, I mean, you know, I mean, Maud Adams played Andrea superbly, but she is an entirely passive, tragic figure, yeah, who is, you know, coerced into doing all manner of awful things before she's finally, you know, murdered. And Mary Goodnight, as Graham pointed out earlier, is just a character in a pantomime, really. I mean, like a out of a Carry On movie. I mean, it's a real shame. You could conceivably have developed the interrelationships between those two and then made it this kind of, and still had the backdrop. You know, make it a chase around, a cat and mouse chase around the world, yeah, you know, and culminating in Bond flying to, you know, Goodnight's rescue, you know, on that island, and having that showdown on that island and still having those elements there, and it would have worked very well. But we'd have believed, I mean, I didn't believe that Bond had any time whatsoever for Goodnight beyond the fact that he would quite like to have sex with her. And, you know, I mean, was he flying to, you know, Goodnight's rescue because he wanted to rescue her or because he wanted to fuck her? And I mean, I don't know whether or not these are really that. When you're thinking about that, you know, you're questioning really the whole point of the thing. I guess what he was really doing there was to have his showdown with Scaramanga. But really, I mean, like, Goodnight is completely incidental in this film. And I think that's a real shame. I don't expect it's 1973, 74, obviously attitudes towards women contemporaneous at the time. But, you know, that's no excuse for not having, you know, good, taking the opportunity to develop, you know, a few love triangles and, you know, adding some extra sex in there. It could have been a really, really, it could have been a really good film.
Yeah.
You say that about so many Bond films.
Yeah. I think you're, when you have a look at how the 60s has gone for Bond girls and you think about, well, the most memorable one out of those early films is obviously Honor Blackman. She's been memorable in that role all the way through the franchise, and yet they seem to be so loath to go back to find other characters like her or to develop strong female characters in the films. They had perfect opportunity here with two good Swedish actresses there. Coming in into to the film and but they just didn't use them at all. I mean, if they were using Maud Adams, it was very, very, very subtly. But there is nothing subtle in this film at all, is there really?
No.
So that was one of the more shocking missed opportunities, I think, in this film is the female characters in it, especially after the last one, because you had Jane Seymour just simpering her way through there, and it was really calling out for a stronger female character in this one, and we don't get it. We barely get it in Spo Love Me, really, with Barbara Bach. I mean, like, all right, she's got a bit more gumption to her, but she's so poorly executed that you don't really get an intelligent woman until Moonraker, and that's why Moonraker is so good, because, you know,
this is why Moonraker is so good.
see how you fall into our trap then. Yeah.
So I'll put out a confession here on the WhatsApp chat. Terry, obviously, if you're not regular into this podcast, you'll know that this is the time to discover that we don't always agree on everything. And the differing of opinion here is that I don't think Moonraker is a particularly good film, and Terry and Graham think it is one of the better films in the canon. Now, I have to admit, having watched Moonraker as well, because obviously I've just been watching all the Bond films all the way through, and watching it very quickly after Man with a Golden Gun, I will definitely confess that Moonraker is a lot more fun and a lot more, much more of a better film, probably for the reasons Terry has outlined, in that it knows its level of ridiculousness and it sticks to its line very, very well. And there's a lot to it. There's a lot in the start that I do quite like about Moonraker. It is an infinitely better film than The Man with the Golden Gun. Are you happy now? Are you not entertained?
Well, I mean, when you place it in your top three, then I'll be happy. But this has been a good day, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know what? I know we've obviously ranked and ordered Bond films as well, but because I've been going through the Moore catalogue at the moment, absolutely have to say that when you're looking at the Moore films, I'm sorry, I can't put Moonraker. There's like four better Roger Moore films than Moonraker easily.
Four.
And four.
Yeah. Four.
Yes.
Go on then.
Okay. So contentiously, this might be contentious, but I do like A View to a Kill. I've got a lot of time for it, and it's mainly because of Christopher Walken and Grace Jones, and there's a level of ridiculousness to it, and it sticks with it, and it's got Duran Duran on the soundtrack as well. So I'll put A View to a Kill just above it. Then, obviously, Octopussy. Octopussy is just such a fantastic film. I absolutely love that. Then you've got Spy Who Loved Me and Live and Let Die, all better than Moonraker.
Do you know what? I think that's perfectly.
This is our next podcast, guys. Okay? Graham, by all means, riposte.
I don't think Gary is necessarily wrong there with those opinions. I'll leave it hanging there, shall I?
I don't think you'll find a lot of people who would agree with that assessment completely, and a lot of people think that Live and Let Die is Moore's best James Bond outing. I would love to spend a great deal of time discussing how wrong that opinion is, and we could do that another time. It is a fine film. We did a commentary on Live and Let Die, and it is a fine film. It's a fine Bond film. Objectively, it's a hideous piece of racist crap. But I mean, as a Bond film, it's good. See also Octopussy. This one is unquestionably the case. Is this ranks among the lowest of the entire franchise? Sadly, it is worth pointing out that when you consider that Saltzman was leaving, the movie was a success in the box office, but not by comparison, as you say, Gary, to Live and Let Die. Then when the legal and implications were played out with Saltzman's departure, there was a delay to the next movie. But in fact, given that it was only Roger's second Bond film, could have been the end of him. He might not have come back.
Yeah.
But fortunately, obviously, they did. And in fact, it was as well that they had that break, because then they were able to come storming back with Spy Who Loved Me, which I think is one of the finest James Bond films ever. So, I mean, and I don't believe you'll find too many people who will disagree with that opinion. There are some quality moments in this movie, though, and there's reasons to like it. I think that the scenes in Macau are really good and really well paced. I like the scene with, Bond and Lazar, for example. I think that's a great scene. Mm.
That's very Fleming, I thought, that scene. Yeah.
Yeah. There are elements of this film, and I think, almost as we're kind of, the theme that's come throughout this podcast is that there's so many missed opportunities, and because it's so uneven, you have some great moments and then some very, very ropey moments immediately put next to it. If this was a version of Bond's Play Your Cards Right, where would you put this sort of in, if we're kind of ranking all the films from best to worst? There's a few which I know I think everybody agrees are a bit of a clunker, which are Die Another Day, which I don't think will really be surpassed. But then you've got likes of For Your Eyes Only, Diamonds Are Forever, The World Is Not Enough. Would you put this one worse than some of those ones? Is it right towards the bottom, or has it got enough redeeming features that it would essentially be bottom end of the table, but safe from relegation?
Yeah, for me, it's safe from relegation because now there's 25 films in the franchise that there's a hell of a lot of really, really, really poor ones there. You're right, Die Another Day just is nailed to the bottom now, and then Diamonds Are Forever just immediately above it. You've not got many put in between those two and this one. I think the World Is Not Enough is a honker. So that one's below it as well. But then you're getting into the time when you've got to be pulling this one in for consideration, I think, because it is that far down the list, which is a shame. As I said to you the other day, Gary, that it's a film that, because of what it's got in there, you want to like. So I think I've panned it quite a lot on this podcast, but it is done with that sort of I think this should have been better. This wasn't something that was just hideously ill-conceived. It was something that they had it there, and they just let it slip through their fingers.
Terry, where do you put Man with a Golden Gun overall in the bottom league of Bond films, if indeed you are putting it there, and I think you probably would be.
Yeah, I think it's in the bottom three for me, Clive. I mean, Die Another Day is very, very difficult to watch. And I would say that probably now these days, Golden Gun, you know, has to fall in that category. Like I said at the top of the show, I've watched the film over and over again when I was a teenager. But, you know, nowadays, you know, with a modern aesthetic, it's very difficult to watch the scenes between Bond and Andrea, you know, in the hotel, the second, you know, where he frankly slaps her around. I mean, are extremely uncomfortable to watch. Now, it's interesting. I mean, Roger Moore, you know, had extreme misgivings about that scene at the time, you know, which only just goes to show what a decent human being he was. It's very difficult, really, to acknowledge and justify those scenes even now. I think that the casting of Nick Knack is an interesting choice, and the choice of a henchman as being a little person is an interesting choice. But I would have to say that I don't believe that even for 1974 it was handled, you know, very skillfully. And when you just add together just the mishmash of set piece action sequences not treated with a great deal of respect, and a plot that seems to have been thrown together. You've got an exceptionally bad James Bond film. I'm tempted to actually place it bottom of the league.
Ooh.
Worse than Die Another Day. I don't think that's a hot take. I don't think that's a hot take.
Are you going below Diamonds Are Forever? Because Diamonds Are Forever is a honker.
That is a real hot mess of rubbish, isn't it? It's just a stinking pile of poo, that movie.
Yeah. There is nothing endearing
about it. There are listeners who like that movie. And the thing about that film is that... Go on.
No, I was just agreeing with you. Yes. Yeah, the thing about this film is...
The thing about Diamonds... It's not offensive.
apart from the gay henchman, yeah?
Yeah, okay, it is offensive. Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, okay. So I don't know. I think you probably, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I think it depends on what you're watching and how you feel at the time. To use another sporting metaphor, there's a cigarette paper between them.
Yeah, I think it's interesting though, because now thinking about Diamonds Are Forever, the bits that are rubbish in this film are the bits that they've seemingly lifted from Diamonds Are Forever. They've got Nick Knack instead of Wint and Kidd, and they've got. Britt Eklund there instead of Tiffany Case there, haven't they? So being the Dolly Bird in the bikini, like for no apparent reason, and that's very much of the time though as well, isn't it? It's like the James Bond newspaper strips of the time. They took that sort of turn, didn't they? Terry, let me his book of the ones that came out in the 70s, and any female character turns up in one strip and there is going to be one panel where she says, yes, let's go and do that, but first I'm going to take my clothes off. And it is that sort of like Benny Hill style sort of carry on.
It's quite good, actually.
Yeah. Riveting, isn't it?
It's all good. All these things do kind of work in their proper places, I suppose. But I think that the conception that Die Another Day is the worst James Bond film is an understandable one, because I think it's a relatively recent film, although it's not that recent. It's nearly 2 decades old. I think if you go further back than that, then you'll find some absolute stinkers. I mean, Golden Gun has the one over Diamonds Are Forever on the bikini stakes, because at least Goodnight is on a glorious, beautiful island in the sunshine. Tiffany Case is wearing a bikini on an oil rig. I mean,
yes. There is no getting away from that.
Silly.
Yes.
No.
Yes. It's there are lots of I mean, we could spend, again, I feel this is a subject for an entire podcast of kind of trying to sort out the least bad Bond films from each other. And as Graham said, there are quite a few honkers in there. I think I will kind of try and sum up, because I know we've been talking for a bit, that whilst I think this is a particularly poor film, and like you, I actually really winced at that scene with Bond and Andrea in the hotel room. That was actually, you know, something that felt very out of character and felt very out of character for Moore. But I think there's enough redeeming features that if you were watching this as a kind of mini summary and it was edited together and cut out the really bad bits, you'd go, oh, this looks like quite a good film. And as we've mentioned, it's got the great start, it's got a very good villain in Christopher Lee, albeit slightly badly written and underplayed where it could have been played, and you've got a really kind of decent tight ending, which is very enjoyable as well. So there's and it's not like, say, Diamonds Are Forever, which really descends into farce, and Die Another Day, which had gone beyond farce by the time you get to an ending as well. And it's not quite as, say, flat as For Your Eyes Only, which just sort of meanders around to an ending rather than doing anything in particular. But so there's enough that's kind of, for me, just about redeemable, but it does require you mentally just forgetting and unseeing everything that is bad about this film before that. It's almost like, to take sort of something that Terry's mentioned a lot, that if you just took the first 30 minutes of Die Another Day, you probably then, and then stop there, you probably go, this is one of the best films in the Bond franchise.
Yeah, Golden Gun is a Bond film, and you know, as such, it is a film that, you know, as Bond fans, we watch and will, after a fashion, enjoy. So I mean, it has that redeeming quality, and it's got some enjoyable moments in it. I mean, I like the scenes in Hyphax Gardens. I love the line we haven't talked about the prop. I know you probably want to wrap up now, so I won't go. But I mean, like, some of the props are amazing. The production design is great. The Golden Gun is superb. What a great idea.
What a concept.
And the way that Christopher Lee manipulated and did that, you know, that when he murdered Hyphax, that was a great scene. And then the great one-liner, though, he always did like that mausoleum, put him in it. You know, that's a great line. You know, so there are definitely moments in this movie that are well worth enjoying, very, very memorable. But maybe, as you say, Gary, more of a highlight reel. You know, Man of the Golden Gun would be an excellent sort of like first or second choice on Match of the Day, you know, as a for highlights.
Yeah.
But, you know, actually, you know, you wouldn't want to watch the whole match because it's a bit boring and a bit crap.
Yeah.
And a bit misogynist.
I wouldn't want to start going down the plot holes route, because if you do that with Bond, I mean, like, you just
you haven't got a rope long enough.
Yeah, no, exactly. But in this, it's so obvious in this one as well. Why does Nick Knack go after Bond after the end? Because it hasn't been the whole thing throughout the whole film, is that he's trying to kill off Scaramanga to get his money. And now Bond's done his dirty work for him. And yet Nick Knack goes, oh, I think I'll go and kill Bond anyway.
Well, I don't have an answer to that, but I have another question. You know, when he went to, quote, Beirut, and you fairness, that fight in the belly dance is great.
It is.
It is a great fight. But, like, why were they attacking him? Who were they working for? Why did those people... Was it simply because he was trying to score with, you know, that bloke's...
Well, because he had to comedically swallow the charm, didn't he?
I understand in terms of the advancement of the movie. I understand from a narrative point of view, but what I would like to know is, why did they just attack him? Who were they working for? For what purpose? You know, I don't get that.
I mean,
it was a great fight scene, and all of that. But I mean.
Yeah.
And she was great.
She was.
She was the best female character in the movie.
Yeah. And her magnificent abdomen. Well, she did. I mean, like you know, she had focus. She had drive. She was a well-rounded character, far more well-rounded than Mary Goodnight. She had a backstory as well, for God's sake.
Yeah.
All she needed to do was converse with another female character, and she would have passed the Bechdel test too. I mean, like, that would have been it. I mean, we would have been holding this film up in high praise.
I really admired her ability to move on. Don't let us forget the past.
I could watch that scene over and over again, though. Really good.
No. It is brilliant. It's possibly the best scene in the movie. It's great.
And I think if one scene sums up the man with the golden gun's contradictions, it is probably that one in a microcosm. So if you get to watch one scene, watch the fight scene in Beirut in the Battle of Chancellor's dressing room. It doesn't matter if it makes no sense, because it really doesn't in context of the rest of the movie, other than to act as a little bit of plot advancement, and that's fine. You don't really need to know the rest of it. So I think it's fair to say that that scene hasn't lost its charm.
Not from where we're standing,
anyway.
Well, I think we've probably come to a point where we've done this film. We've probably spent more time thinking about it than most other people have. If you want to watch it, if you want to disagree with it, because I do know, you know, there are a lot of people out there who do genuinely quite like this film. And it's certainly not one that I think necessarily always appears towards the bottom of people's lists. There definitely seems from again, what I've kind of did a bit of reading, and there's a fair bit of affection. And I think, you know, it's fair to say we have affection for, we have moderate affection in certain areas for this film. And perhaps lesser affection in other areas. But yeah, I think we've certainly got Man with the Golden Gun there, but really, like, if you're going to watch Bond, you can probably skip through this one, have a bit of a snooze, go and get some popcorn, and just go and sit down and watch The Spy Who Loved Me instead.
Darn tootin'.
Yep.
Yeah. Because really, if you're talking peak Roger, that is definitely peak
Roger.
Yeah,
The best Roger Moore James Bond film is Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah.
Second best is Moonraker. Obviously.
Obviously so. It's the golden period, isn't it? That is indeed the
imperial phase.
Yeah.
It's when Bond had wood. Mr. Wood. Good.
That is a very man with the golden gun line there. Well done.
That would have been delivered impeccably by Roger, because we all know that his one-liners are by far and away the best of everything.
When we do Spy Love Me and Moonraker, well, obviously we will just have to just like call it something like Back to Back Wood or something like that, or Massive Wood.
And I think we know that we've hit the point with the end of the podcast where the wood gags come out. But yes, if you, dear listener, agree or disagree, you might even start getting into the heated debate about where Moonraker sits in Roger Moore's overall films, which I'm sure will feed into another podcast very soon, and would have probably be the most heated podcast that we would have had so far. But yes, if you disagree, if you have a big fondness for Man with the Golden Gun, or if you think that it's worse than Die Another Day, don't at us. Actually, you can. At OddJobPod on Twitter, Facebook as well, OddJobPod, and obviously do subscribe if you like more. And if you want to know a bit more about where we put these various films in there, go ahead and, given that we're all got a bit more time on our hands, spend a couple of hours listening to our World Cup of Bond podcast, because it's quite unlike anything else that you'll hear. Probably for quite a long time. Best done with a glass of port in hand.
Two bottles of port, I think. And then whatever random booze you can find in your drawers as well.
just mix it all up into a big pint glass and down it in one, and you're good to go.
You will be in the same frame of mind that we were when that podcast was recorded.
Yeah, as long as you've got a semi-naked Hong Kong girl on a revolving table to pour it for you, then I think that's what you really need.
And with that, I think we will wrap up. Now, normally I'd say goodbye, but I feel on this one, it's only fair to say good night.
Good night, good night.
Good night.
Yes.
Yes, let's... sir, she is just coming.
Yeah, let's all jump on Scaramanga's junk and get out of here.
The odd jump pod will understandably return, God knows what in what frame we will be in by that stage. But until then, check out our back catalogue, enjoy and sail away on the junk, and try not to think too hard about the troubling elements of this film. And it's goodbye from Vigar Andrews, and goodbye from the rest of us.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.